Okay, welcome everybody. My name is Frederick Fuller. I'm chairing this session. And we start with Ben Christensen talking on computations involving spin networks, spin forms, quantum gravity, and levitation.
Thank you. I'd like to thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to speak here. So the theme of my talk will be to give many examples of situations where computation has led to some insight or further progress in some area of physics. And in particular, I'm going to talk about quantum gravity and a little bit at the end about lattice gauge theory. So I'll be describing lots of different examples. I'll have to be very brief with each one. And I will also be talking about work that many people did. So I'll try to cite people as I go through. So the outline is that I'm going to start by talking about the Barrett-Crane model. And I'll talk about some old computations about its behavior. I'll talk about the positivity result that we discovered. And then I'll talk about some new computations about the quantum deformed version. After that, I'll focus a bit on the 10J symbol, which is the key ingredient for the Barrett-Crane model. I'll talk about its asymptotics and also about the graviton propagator. And then finally, I'll talk about how you can use some of the same methods to study lattice gauge theory. Okay, so first I'll briefly review the Riemannian Barrett-Crane model. And everything I do will be Riemannian. And I might make one comment about the Lorentzian version. So the setup is that we start with a triangulation of a manifold. Just for simplicity, I'll assume it's closed, but that doesn't really change much. And we're going to call the triangles dual faces and call the set of them script F, the tetrahedra are the dual edges, script E, and the four simplices of the dual vertices, script V. So a spin form in this setup is just an assignment, a labeling of each triangle with a spin, a representation of SU2. So each dual face or each triangle gets labeled with a spin. If you have such a spin form, you have to press with the mouse wheel here, and you have to not turn it. There we go. If you have such a spin foam, its amplitude... Is there another pointer? Is this one you have to use the wheel? If someone has another pointer, I would like it. The amplitude is a product of contributions that come from the dual faces, the dual edges, and the dual vertices. The contribution from the dual vertex is the 10J symbol. It can be thought of as a contraction of 5 four-valent tensors, or it can be thought of as an integral over 5 copies of SU2. Either way is actually very hard to compute, and there's a completely different way that you can use to compute it very efficiently. So that part has been very well studied. The other parts are normalization factors that depend on the exact version of the Barrett-Crane model you take. Okay, so I'll begin by describing some work in 2002 with John Byers, myself, Tom Halford, and David Tsang. These were undergraduate students working with me. And in this example, we fixed, we just looked at the triangulation of the four-sphere that comes from the boundary of the five-simplex. So this is the simplest triangulation of the four-sphere. And then we wanted to compute some expectation values of observables. We focused on the average area observable. So this sum is a sum over the faces of this triangulation, over the triangles or the dual faces of the area. Thank you. Okay. There we go. So this is a sum over the triangles or the dual faces of the area contributed by the spin divided by the number of faces. So this is the average area. And then you do the usual way of calculating an expectation value of an observable. You multiply it by the amplitude, sum it up. Now this sum is over all spin foams. In other words, all labelings of this particular triangulation by spins, and you divide by the partition function. So the result that we found showed very strong dependence on these normalization factors. And we were surprised by that. We thought they were just some constants that came out a little bit different depending on exactly the form of the model you chose. But in fact, they completely determined the behavior of the models. So the first model we studied was the Perez-Ravelli model. And in this model, the amplitude was dominated by the case where you just label everything with spin zero, with some minor corrections from spin half labels, and very, very small corrections from higher spin labels. In contrast, we used the other model we call the DFKR model, DiPietri, Friedel, Krasnov, and Ravelli. And in that case, this observable diverges. So it's really dominated by the high spin contributions. So this is just sort of the first example where we just computed something like an average area. We didn't have any idea what would come out, and we found a surprising result. Along the way, we realized that in order to do these computations, I didn't mention it, but it was on the previous slide, we used the Metropolis algorithm, which works best when the amplitudes are all positive real numbers. And they were, and I hadn't really, you know, thought about why, and I discussed this with John Bias, so this part is joint work with him, and he was also surprised. He hadn't expected them to be that way either, and we thought there was maybe a mistake, but we sat down and we were able to show that, in fact, they are always positive real numbers. So computation of that was great. It let us use the Metropolis algorithm without worrying about a sign problem. But conceptually, it raised some issues. What did it mean if you're doing a path integral and the amplitudes of all the paths didn't interfere? They were all positive. So, you know, upon discussing this with various people, it sort of became clear that if you have to think about the path integral as a projection onto physical states. So again, this is an example where we were exploring, we saw these positive numbers come out that we didn't expect, and then it led to an analytic result where we could show that it really was correct, and then that led to some conceptual understanding. Okay, so more recently, and this is joint work with my student Igor Kavkin, we've studied the quantum deformed version where we replaced the group SU2 by the quantum group SUQ2. Okay. So we focused so far on the case where Q is a root of unity, e to the I pi over R, where R is a positive integer, and one effect of doing this is it regularizes the theory. It eliminates all spins greater than this cutoff, r minus 2 over 2. And as you let r go to infinity, the quantum parameter q goes to 1, which produces the usual representation theory of SU2. Another reason to be interested in this is that Lise Mullen has suggested that this r parameter is inversely related to the cosmological constant. So we decided to do some computations there. Along the way, we generalized the computations in other ways. We can do a larger triangulation, and we can use different observables. Okay, so I'll be brief here because two talks from now, Igor will be speaking, and he'll fill in more of the details. I want to just focus here on the hollow dots, or the hollow triangles and hollow squares, the two top rows. So along the bottom is the deformation parameter r, this root of unity parameter. So as r increases, you go towards the undeformed q equals 1 limit. And this scale is rather arbitrary. And what we've plotted are expectation values of two different observables. So the top row here is the average area, just times the scale factor to bring it into the graph. And the second row is the average spin, again times a scale factor. So in the first case, you see that as you let the r parameter increase, you roughly tend towards a limit which agrees with the undeformed value. But in the case of the average spin, you approach a limit very closely. There's no oscillations at all, and the error bars aren't visible. There's some error bars shown here, but they're very small here. But the limit you approach is not the undeformed value. So again, we had no idea that this would be an effect there. We weren't even looking for it, but the computations revealed that. And this is sort of mysterious to me. I mean, we can now see in retrospect why it comes out this way from the mathematics, but we don't really know what it means. So as you move q towards 1, your computations don't reproduce the q equals 1 value. There's a discontinuity. Okay, next topic is asymptotics. So the key ingredient of the Barrett-Crane model is this 10J symbol, and so it's been well studied by many people. One important study of it was by Barrett and Williams in 98. So to set that up, now I'll tell you one definition of the 10J symbol. So you've got 10 spins, JKL, where K and L range between 1 and 5, and you can think of it as an integral over 5 copies of the 3-sphere, or you could say SU2 if you want, of a product of 10 kernels, where each of the kernels is a character, an SU2 character. So sine of 2j plus 1 phi over sine phi. So in this notation, these xi's are unit vectors on the 3-sphere. They're unit vectors in R4, and the phi variables are the angles between them. And so you can actually think of this as an integral over a space of 4 simplices. So if you think of these unit vectors as being normals to 3-dimensional subspaces of R4, and you take these 5 subspaces and push one of them off the origin a little bit, they surround a 4 simplex. And it's uniquely determined up to scale, up to an overall scale factor. So this integral can be thought of as an integral over all 4 simplices up to a scale factor. Now, what Barrett and Williams found is that if the spins J, KL are large, then the stationary phase points of this integral are focused, correspond to the points in the domain of integration that represent four simplices whose areas are equal to 2jkl plus 1, where those are the spins labeling the faces. This is a slightly different area formula than I mentioned before, and sometimes one comes up, sometimes the other. So they found that those four simplices that match the geometry given by the spins are the ones that dominate the stationary phase points, and that they contribute according to the Reggie action. So it was a very nice result. So once again, we decided, well, let's just compute it. We know how to compute 10J symbols now. We had an algorithm to do that. So let's just put in some large spins and see what we get. And we found we didn't get what that formula predicted. So one way to say it is, if you scale all spins by a factor lambda, the contributions from the stationary phase points should go like lambda to the minus 9/2. So they should decay quite quickly. But in fact, our computation showed they decayed like lambda to the minus 2, which is, they were much larger than they should have been, and there were no oscillations like there should have been. So at this point, several independent groups, so myself with Baez and Egan and Barrett and Steele and Fardell and Luapra, all at around the same time discovered that this was due to contributions from degenerate four simplices. So in the space of integration, you've got these five unit vectors, and in cases where at least two of them are parallel, the volume of the four simplex is zero. And those points were noticed by Barrett and Williams, but they didn't look at the contribution they gave. And it turns out that contribution dominates the contribution from the stationary phase points. Okay. So again, this was something where we were just doing some computations and we noticed something that didn't match what was expected and led to some new theory, and it's also led to new proposals for the vertex amplitude. Here's a graph just showing the behavior. So this is in my paper with Baez and Egan. The straight lines are the lambda to the minus 2 lines. It's a log-log plot. There's six different 10J symbols shown, and then each one is scaled by a lambda factor. And you see they really approach these lines directly without any oscillations or anything else being visible. Okay, so this is a related topic in that it involves looking at the 10J symbol for large spins. And luckily, Carlo introduced this so I don't have to give a lot of the details. As he mentioned in his talk, he gave a proposal for defining a two-point function in the Barrett-Crane model, and the formula looks something like this. So in both the numerator and the denominator, there's a 10J symbol. That's the amplitude of a spin foam with one four simplex. There's a boundary state that I'll say more about in a second. And then in the numerator, you have field insertions, which are a difference of Casimirs. So I'm going to just write that a bit smaller right here. So the denominator I've just called N, and this is the same formula. It's a sum over all labelings of a four simplex, all labelings of the triangles of a four simplex. So there's 10 summation indices here. Okay, then the boundary state that Carla proposed is a Gaussian that's peaked around a regular four simplex. There's some variations in what you choose here. I've written down a simple form. So here you imagine you've got a four simplex that's regular, and you use J naught to determine the area of the triangles, and phi is the dihedral angle, and then you peak this Gaussian about spin centered at J naught, and you have an oscillatory term involving the dihedral angle. So with that state, first of all, what you should expect is that the calculation you do here goes as 1 over J naught, because J naught is like an area, and Rovelli argued that that's the case, and we had trouble verifying that in numerical computations, just mainly because they were too difficult to do. So then Levine and Speciale proposed a different boundary state. Now this isn't proposed for physical reasons, it's proposed because it's easier to work with, despite how complex it looks. So it involves Bessel functions, modified Bessel functions of the first kind. The nice thing is it factors into one contribution for each spin, but it does look more complicated. This is a reasonable choice if you want to study the asymptotic behavior, because asymptotically it does behave like a Gaussian times a cosine factor. So you should expect to get the same asymptotics from this choice of boundary state as from the Gaussian boundary state. But mathematically, the nice property it has is its SU2 transform is simple to compute analytically, and if you do that, you can exchange the summation over spins that appeared in the formula for the two-point function with an integral over five copies of SU2. And this integral, I should mention we tried to do the summations in the original formula, and you just need to do too many terms to get convergence. The integral is computable, but it's just barely computable. So here's a plot. Along the bottom, we've got the J-naught, the spin that determines the size of the regular four simplex, and then we've got the value of this two-point function. This is just the diagonal part that Carlo talked about today. I fixed this alpha at a certain value, an arbitrary value, and you see that the red line here, that's the 1 over J-naught behavior that you expect, including a predicted coefficient that Tara Levine and Simone Speziali have computed. And you see it's roughly going to that, but at high spins, there's huge error bars. These are only one sigma error bar, so there's really a lot of error here. And at low spins, we've managed to get the error down, but there's a huge amount of oscillation, so it's not very clean. This plot took about 5 CPU years to produce. So it took a lot of effort to get the errors as low as we did, and it's still not very satisfying. And like I said, even where the errors are small, it's not that convincing. I mean, it's fairly convincing, but it's not as nice as it could be. So more recently, and I'll say this is very tentative, this is results from the last week or so, one thing that Simone and I noticed is that state that was used that involved the Bessel functions, well, I didn't say it explicitly, but when the J that appears there differs from J-naught by a half integer, as opposed to an integer, they're actually implicitly setting it to zero. Okay? They're only dealing with integer spins in that paper. Well, we've noticed that if you use the same formula, but put all, you don't set it to zero artificially for half spins, that the Fourier transform is actually even simpler. So I think this is better in a lot of ways. First of all, it's artificial to be setting this equal to zero. So it's a physically nicer state. It even better approximates a Gaussian. But it turns out that because the Fourier transform is a bit easier, the numerical integrations are easier. And finally, the graph turns out to be much cleaner. So here's the graph. So it's the same axes. There's a little bit of noise down here, which I think is just numerical error. But you see a very nice trend towards this 1 over J-naught behavior, with maybe a 1 over J-naught squared correction coming in here. And you also see a very interesting effect for low spins, where there's a damping effect here. And this is something that we're looking into. So not only are the error bars much, much smaller, this only took 1/7 of the computational time. So it was much easier to do this computation. Okay. But I'll repeat, it's very tentative. We're still checking some of the details of the Fourier transform. Okay, how much time do I have? Okay, perfect. Okay, so the last thing I want to talk about is how you can use similar computational methods to study lattice gauge theory. So many people, and I've written a few names here, but many, many people have thought about this. Many people observe that you can use spin foam methods to compute in lattice gauge theory. And it's an exact duality. It's not an approximation. It's related to the strong coupling expansion, but it's an exact expression. You change the integrations over group variables that label edges into summations over representation variables that label the faces and the edges, in fact. And so you've replaced the integrals from lattice gauge theory with sums over spin foams, essentially. The terms in the sum involve computing something called an 18J symbol, which is given by an octahedral network like this, where you've labeled the 12 edges and the 6 vertices with spins, and then you have to evaluate the spin network. In joint work with my students, Wei Charrington and Igor Kavkin, we've figured out a way to compute that 18J symbol efficiently, and we've done computations for the simplest non-trivial, in particular the simplest non-abelian lattice gauge theory. So we've only done three-dimensional pure SU2 Yang Mills at this point, but for that case we get exact agreement. So let me tell you what the plot is. So gamma here is the coupling constant, that's the x-axis. This is the average spin, that's the observable we took for our first computations. And this is two curves which are right on top of each other. One is conventional lattice gauge theory group integrations, and the other is the summations over spin foams. And you can see that they're essentially identical. The inset plot is the relative error, and the error is always within about 1%. So this way is a viable way to do computations, and we plan to push it a lot further. For more details, the next talk in this session is by Wei Charrington. He'll talk about this. And the first talk in the next session, I believe, is Florian Conradi, who will talk about related material as well. Okay, so now I'll just sum things up. We found that by doing computations, even if we didn't know exactly what we expected to find, in every case, essentially, we found new and unexpected results. In many of those cases, we were able to show analytically what was going on, but we wouldn't have thought to show that if we hadn't noticed some pattern already. Using the computations, you can often choose between existing models or suggest new models. And the last point is that computational techniques from one area, like spin foams and spin networks, are sometimes useful in other areas. So there can be some transfer here. Okay, and I'll end with a cartoon. So Calvin says, "If I had a computer, I'm sure I'd get better grades in my book reports." And his father says, "You'd still have to read the book and tell the computer what you want to say, you know." And Calvin says, "Man, what's all the fuss about computers?" Well, it's true, you do have to put some effort into telling the computer what to do, and I hope I've convinced you that it can be rewarding and can lead to new results. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? So, you showed us three candidates for this army space. I was the original one, and fighting through the one. It would be nice to understand that because we're in that physical effect of what we're doing. Now, for small particle complex, it was the case that you first took coherent states with fixed bit. Now, that peaked at some point. With the fixed bit everywhere, then we found that it's not able to control the constraint through the evolution.
Mm-hmm.
So, what we're going to do was to adjust the bit depending on which point you are. So, it's like your J naught.
Right.
I'm that is what you're seeing as you're going from Carlos 1 to the speciality.
No, that already happens. I seem to have lost control. Oh, there we go. No. Okay. The Gaussian state I wrote down here for Carlos' choice does have this in the very first part of the exponential. No, that's not working either. There's this alpha over J naught behavior controlling the width. Okay. So that actually wasn't there in the very first proposal, and that came later to correct some problems. Okay. And that's actually what makes it very hard to compute. I could compute it when that wasn't there, and then it wasn't working properly. But with that there, I can't compute it because it makes the width of the Gaussian too large.
Then do you understand the previous case?
Well, for large spins, they're very similar. So the only difference is in small spins, and I'm not proposing that either of the states involving Bessels are physically meaningful. It's just that they're easier to do the computations with for large spins. So I think it's just it's a way to approximate a state like this in a way where we can compute some things analytically.
I just wanted to say that it's basically contact, it was pretty fast wrong in my book. And it was correct in the table of mind, but it's actually supposed to be sad to do that.
So okay.
My question was about Engels.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a basic question. You say here, you said, now, Engels said the heavy computational problems comes when you go out to the conventional approximation and you want to do the proxy. One would tend to say that now here the proxy is simpler because you don't have to go to the turbulence just like that for new kind of.
Well, so we don't know actually whether it's going to be more efficient. So our computations so far have just been to make sure we got it all correct, because the details were very complicated with signs and other things in the spin networks. So at this point, the curves we got were about equally hard, very roughly, and neither side of the code was highly optimized, and we're not using state-of-the-art techniques on either side. So all we know at this point is it's worth investigating. It could be more efficient for some situations. We're not 100% sure. So
comparable,
probably
still be
the conventional
distribution. Because that's where
you can
come back
to more
technique. Right, it's possible.